Hello, hello, and welcome to this week's podcast. Boom, yeah, yeah, shake the room. Boom, 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 shake the room. Boom, boom, boom. Who's Gail Vella? That's what I want to know. Who is Gail Vella? Is she the news lady? Is the news lady Gail Vella? I've not been paying attention too much. I have a bit. I mean, I clocked that it was Neil from the office on that recording before the characters clocked it was. So I'm one step ahead of the line of duty characters. That's what I'm referring to for those who don't know. I'm one step ahead of the line of duty characters because they were like, oh, I can't quite place him. Can't quite place him. I was like, it's Neil from the office. He was in the Tandy Newton series. And then he went, yeah, I've nailed him. I've got him. I've got the pig. And I was like, oh, about time. I guessed it was him 4 words ago, you daft idiot. Did any of you know he would come back into circulation? I mean, there's a few, isn't there? I mean, there's ones who are dead. Who do you think is... Actually, I don't want to... There's already a Line of Duty podcast. I'm not going to... You know, they've got the natural budget. They're getting paid. They're getting paid to do that podcast. It's I can't remember who's fronting it. Anyway, it's through the BBC podcast. They're getting paid quite handsomely to do that podcast, unlike me. So I'm not giving you the paid content, is what I'm saying. Giving some of you in there, the Patreon streamers, I'm giving some of you the paid content. That's why you get a little bonus in bit at the beginning of me just chatting. I mean, I talked about... I will talk about care work, actually, as is my want. As is my want. I've been piggybacking off the... piggybacking on the backs of people with dementia who, you know, curvature of the spine. They have quaver backs, a lot of them. So it's not... Actually, it's not good. It's not a good thing. Also, no one gives a shit about elderly care. So if I'm going to... if I'm going to parlay my activism into, enhancing my visibility or profile, I've gone the wrong way about it because no one gives a fuck about elderly care. You can already see the renewed focus on elderly care from the pandemic drain away quite quickly. They glanced and then they diverted their gaze. They glanced and then they diverted because they realised, oh, no, that fucking stinks. Now them boys fucking stink. I want to be with cool. I want to be cool ass charities like AIDS. At least there's like a sexual component to AIDS. So, but also a hell of a lot of heartbreak. Hell of a lot of it. Elderly care. There is. I mean, I hope to God there isn't a sexual component. I mean, we had couples who were married couples in the care home who were, you know, sometimes caught in flagrante in a state of undress. And some of the carers would try and break it up. They're fucking married. Like, they were people who were married. And they were, you know, doing what married people do. It's, like, you know, wonderful for them. Like, they've still got that libido, that libidinous drive. And carers would go in and again break it up. Isn't that fucking mental? That isn't policy. I don't think you have to allow like conjugal visits. I mean, it's even calling it conjugal visits. It's not a prison. They can do what they want. My nan used to fling it about. I said that in the last one. She really did. Sadly, she thought all of them were my granddad Frank. So she was working for a load of Frank proxies and going, box them, Frank, box them, when the carers were intervening because my granddad used to do boxing. But then these guys were like, I don't know what you want from me. I'm a cartographer. I've never boxed a day in my life. They're the kind of men who... They go up to people when the wife goes, "Can you deal with him? Actually, be a man for once and deal with him." And they go, "I bloody well will, all right? I will. You want me to be a man? I'll be a man. Just leave the room a minute and make sure you're out of earshot." right? No, I'm going to deal with it. I'm not going to pussy out. I'm not a fucking pussy. I'm not a pussy. Just get out of the room, out of earshot, all right? Further. Close the door. Helen? No, she can't hear me. I am really sorry about that, mate. Yeah, I am so sorry. I'm so sorry about her. She's been like it ever since the kids left home. Gets hot flashes a lot. Quite become quite a bitter woman in her old age. That's not what I married. That's not what I married. Didn't marry that. So I'm ever so sorry, mate. No. It's not your fault at all. No, mate. Yes. I've never done a handshake like that before with someone. Like, can we? That's our one. That's our handshake. Yeah. Practice. You want to practice on the weekend? No, you've got plans? Oh, no, that's fine. No, I've got plans. Got plans. Gonna bloody get the old ball. All right, Helen, I'm coming. Okay, that was a play for today brought to you by Nesquik. All right. Today we're going to talk about meritocracy. That was the intended topic. Let's read an article, Snakes and Ladders by Stefan Collini in the LRB. It's been nice, eye-opening, you know. It's good because it's a kind of a palliative, if that's right, about a palliative for my own sense of unfulfillment and bitterness of being in an industry that's hyper-competitive, but then you see people who are getting ahead because they have the money and the resources to carve out a nice bit of time for themselves to actually work on their creative pursuits and also skills and connection. Like, I think there's a relational privilege. How I described it to my mate. One sec, let me just go. I might regret saying this. It's kind of ill thought out, but it's something I've kind of felt at certain points. And someone will probably, I also think there's something to be said for relational privilege, like in comedy, as people who aren't necessarily socioeconomically privileged, or not massively, but they're all part of this incestuous little clique. And if one becomes successful, it enhances the collective social capital of the rest of the group. So they all start getting recommended for gigs or booking each other to act in sketches and short films. And because they're all working together and promoting each other, they're all grabbing opportunities. Do you know, they're like swallowing it up, all the opportunities, as a big amorphous blob, like kind of blocking the sunlight for other people who are outside of the clique. And there'll be people who just say to me, that's just having friends, mate. Like, there's no privilege in having friends. There's no privilege. You can't say being friends with people is a privilege. And they would be right. They'd be right. It's ill thought out. There's not much to it. But there also is as well. That's the thing. I kind of believe it. But I maybe privilege is the wrong word. What I'm trying to say is, let me be part of your blob. Let me in. Let me in, for the love of Christ, let me in. Let me be part of your blob or clique. So in this article, it says, we are asked to believe in a world in which individual agents are in full possession of undivided selves, unshaped by social determinants, and able to realize outcomes simply by willing them strongly enough. The myth of hard work and industriousness creating expediency within your chosen occupation. It is assumed that there is an uncomplicated thing called talent or ability, and that some people have more of it than others. It is also assumed, pretty much as a fact of nature, it seems, that some people will make more effort and work harder than others. Meritocracy proposes to rearrange the world, shouldn't take too long, so that for those who combine ability and effort, every day is Christmas Day. The sham of equality of opportunity. And it's here that journalists and politicians alike may express amazement and outrage at each fresh revelation that advantage is cumulative and self-perpetuating. Yet sociologists and radical social theorists cannot fall back on saying, I told you so each time. So it's like people who become rich have the, they might have inherited wealth, become rich, have money to make sure their kids have elite schooling, or like they have tutors and stuff that will prepare them for these, you know, these hurdles, like, you know, these hurdles you have to jump in order to get into elite schooling. So wealth creates wealth. Such narratives recognize, in Joe Littler's actually Against Meritocracy, which I have bought, and I've spoken to her, Joe Littler. She was part of the Care Collective, who wrote the Care Manifesto. It's brilliant. And such narratives recognize the egalitarian deficit as a meritocratic deficit and prescribe competitive neoliberal meritocracy as a solution, which in turn produces more inequality. Yeah, it's like I do you know what? I work very hard in trying to build a career in comedy, kind of from scratch. Like, I didn't have any entry point when I first started comedy. I didn't have any connections that could help to that could kind of help me on my way, which I'm seeing with some people. I'm seeing people who, you know, very new, but they're kind of being they're being rushed through the process of incubation and development that you have to go through as a newer act, where you have to do the open mic circuit, you have to do very thankless unpaid gigs for a long time until you can actually, you know, year three is when I started getting a trickle of paid work, which grew and grew and grew. But even that might be quite premature. That might be quite premature. Because I'm fucking bored of my material, I'll tell you that much. I'm bored of my kind of main 20. It's a baggy 20 as well. I'd say it's a 50. I'd say it's a solid 15. And a baggy 20. So the frequently repeated claim that social mobility is ground to a halt in the last couple of decades is an example of historical ignorance compounding confused thinking. So in the 20th century, especially in the years between 1945 and 1980, there was a transformation in the occupational structure of most of the advanced economies, whereby a large number of sort of blue-collar jobs that were replaced by white-collar jobs, to use the American parlance. Several processes were at work here. So you had deindustrialization, the growth of the service economy, the increase in the public sector, and so on. At the same time, the school leaving age was progressively raised and the expansion of higher education began. This complex of changes has deposited in popular memory the idea that those who came to maturity in these years were socially mobile, that they rose to a higher position in society than their working class parents. So I've got grandparents who are solidly working class, a mum who's solidly working class, a dad who did go to university when it was still the top 4 percentile. He studied numbers. Counting. He's accounting. Studied accounting. Did an accounting with numbers. He studied accountancy. Binned that off quite quickly, so he thought it was boring as shit. And it was, of course, true that these changes, along with rising prosperity and better public services, did improve the lives of a large section. Oh, can you hear that? Rag and bone man. Believe that? He comes past every week. You don't think they exist anymore, but they do. That's proof of that. When I tell people I've got rag and bone man, people are like, that's a myth. That's what you're describing there is called a folk tale. What you're describing there is folklore. Oh, through the mist. I was like, no, there's an actual rag and bone man. And he's actually friends with John Across the Road. And John Across the Road saw a picture of me in the paper doing stand-up comedy and was like, oh, yeah, I thought you were my mate. And Jeffrey Jefferson. And I went, oh, well, is he a good-looking guy? He went, where's the rag and bone man? I said, you cheeky fucking fool, yeah. Yeah. You watch yourself, John. You watch it. And so, yeah, people's lives improved. Though the class position of the majority remained little altered in relative terms. But the experience of these historically specific conditions has been transmuted into an assumption that social mobility, understood exclusively as moving upwards, is a natural and continuing feature of a properly functioning society. Wait, where's the books? There we go. I can see how meritocracy is a myth. Because the public culture definitely proclaims the virtues of effort and ambition and enjoins individuals to unlock their potential, while all the evidence suggests that the class structure, understood as a set of objective relations rather than subjective attitudes, is in fact largely immobile. So that nothing, that doesn't change. The class structure doesn't change. Even though they put in the work, they graft, they try to be self-made men and women, and they try to climb upwards so that they can actually, you know, have some decking in the garden, which is, as we know, the main arbiter of social mobility, is having decking in the garden or a bowls of balls or bundles of sticks as decorations, stuff like that. Oh, I'm going out on cold. Oh, I'm having a hot flash. I actually am. Oh, God, I don't feel well. Imagine if I just did actually die on this. Imagine if I did. That would be such an inconvenient time to die, because I haven't actually made any kind of cultural impact yet. Like, at least when the book comes out, it's something, isn't it? It's something tangible. That's like, there you go. Indelible mark. Even if just within 5 years, it's been sold in bargain bins for 99p. It doesn't matter. It is out there. There's always a chance that it could be, when I'm dead on the podcast, that it could be discovered in years' time. About, oh, this is an unappreciated classic. It's an unappreciated classic, this. Didn't get enough recognition in its time. Let's release it now. And the New York Review Books imprint. And then, like, that book Stoner, suddenly, oh, look, it's got the acclaim. It's got posthumous acclaim. Years, decades after it was first released. Then again, probably not. I mean, I'm the kind of guy. Like, I hold quite a lot of bitterness about a lot of things, but also about the care work that I do because the care work isn't a career path for me, but it has become an important part of my life in the sense that I feel like I can articulate why intimate labor, the range of work that entails closeness with others. This is from Sarah Jaffe's brilliant book, actually, Work Won't Love You Back. She says the range of work that entails closeness with others can include knowledge of personal information as well as bodily contact and touch. Sometimes it involves having another person's life in your hands. Other times the stakes are lower. But what all intimate labor has in common is that it brushes up against the line between what we think should be done for love and what we think should be done for money. I ain't doing it for the money. The money's shit. I'm only in work, as I said, like 10, 15 hours now. I go in, I do one-to-one care with one guy, and there's a little group of the people in the care home who, when I come in, like I'm a new face, so they are, you know, they gravitate towards me to talk about their day and stuff. They're friends. They're friends, which sounds patronising. It's, oh, the home phone's going. Wait for that to go. See, if I had some of that Line of Duty podcast money, we'd have egg cups on the wall to stop that. We have egg cup lining on the wall. It's not for me. Never for me. Anyway, so back to podcast. So yeah, they're friends ish. I mean, they're kind of friends. They're friendly. They're certainly friendly. I mean, they are friends. They are friends, but with very limited communication skills. So I mean, they're my friends within that, the strict parameters of that environment. I mean, you lot are my friends in here. I say to them, you're my closest friends in here and in current proximity. You are my closest friends in quotation marks. You are my friends in quotation marks, truly. But, you know, so sometimes I want to have a proper conversation. I want to talk. I want to talk about current events, and you just want to talk about currants and raisins. Just talk about fucking currants and raisins. Don't know why you've settled on that as a conversational topic. You need to diversify your range of conversation subjects, because currants ain't cutting it, or raisins, both the same thing. And you know it, Helen. We have this every time. But they're my friends. They're my friends. It's definitely my friends. No, truly not. Come on. No doubt about it. They're my friends. Come on. They actually are. I see them more than anyone else. I'm not about, I talk to them more than anyone else. So they really are my friends. So I find the further that you move up the ladder in that kind of career, it's really the kind of career where you should not be losing touch with the things you do for love or just general compassion. And the more you move up the ladder, the more they lose their grasp on that. But according to Jaffe in that book, there's a coercion behind the mask of love, which I definitely recognize. Like, intimate laborers are emotionally manipulated into committing to such work, despite the privatization of care, of care, and as a result of that, the privatization of stress, the proliferation of depression, and a rise in anxiety. And so we're split into these separate spheres between carers and management, with profit as the driving motivation for the shrewd, muggy capitalists, who isn't necessarily the managements, they're not that well paid, but they're definitely the directors of, you know, the care provider companies, exploiting the Sisyphean drudgery of their workers. So it's difficult for us on this side of the fence to see the benefits of shoving a new resident into a room that's barely been vacated by the last occupant. And you're in a position where you can still smell the urine infection of the person who used to live there. So you get a bit misty-eyed thinking about their infected piss. But on my days off, I walk past the company HQ of the old company I used to work for, the care company, because it's local to me. During my morning walk, jog, walk, have a donut. Walk, jog, walk, have a donut. You've got to have reward yourself at the end. You need to incentivize exercise, otherwise you need to incentivize it with something that will, if you're looking at cost benefit analysis. That's it. What the cost is, what the benefit is. You look at a cost-benefit analysis of exercise, you need to have something that is proportionate to the amount of exercise you did and the amount of fat you burn off of your body. And the thing that is proportionate is the something that contains the amount of fat you just burn off. So you're always staying exactly the same. You're always staying exactly the same weight. You're never making any progress, but that stops you from feeling depressed if you were to slide back a little bit, but you won't be sliding back a little bit. You're not making any progress, but you're also not making any opposite of progress. Regress, egress. No, egress is... actually regress, egress. I know egress is to exit something, that's right. So regress, you're also not making progress, but you're also not regressing. You're not progressing, but you're not regressing. Oh God, thank God I got all that little tangle. Thought I was going to be trapped in that forever then. So recently I stopped and stared through the window at one of the senior team members in the company HQ as he sat at his desk looking fretful during a phone conversation and tapped a pen on the ridge of his nose to release some of the percolating stress of the job. They do feel stress as well. They're not inhuman, not monsters. They are just people. And to see him in this blank Tupperware office, inadvertently exhibiting himself in this sort of really unguarded posture, it helped to humanize the enemy. Because, I mean, up to that point, I've often considered flashing my arsehole to the senior team members and opening it up like I'm tearing through a bin bag as a point to make a point. But, I mean, where are all these competitors trying to get to? With meritocracy. That was one of the quotes in this. It's quite good. I'll read it. So it said, and of course, there will always be some people who prefer to take the lift. In ladder speak, tends to ignore the fact that ladders are used for descending as much as ascending, descending as much as ascending. And there's nothing to say about what happens when someone on the way down meets someone on the way up. And of course, there will always be some people who prefer to take the lift. And where in any case are all these competitors in the great ladder climbing championships trying to get to? That's in the article by Stefan Collini. The metaphor suggests a once and for all ascent. You climb a ladder to get somewhere, but ladder climbing isn't a way of life. It shouldn't be a way of life anyway. I mean, so where are they all trying to get to? What's at the top of the ladder? I mean, I could say the motion towards attainment, the hours of hustling and networking, trying to build a comedy career, is the ultimate province of meaning. But I learned more about the nature of things from like a low-paid, dead-end job, from picking up an omelette of coagulated blood that seeped out the head of an injured old lady. I mean, the main lesson was there was if you're old, don't fall down. And that some people have podgy blood. Also, so I'll tell you quickly about this. So on Christmas, we can sometimes give the residents a bit. We used to do this thing at Christmas on the care shift. If I used to always work the Christmas shift, and one of the CTMs who I was very close to is, you know, quite a sort of old school matronly, unapologetically bolshy lady like my mum, but she was a bit harder than my mum. Underneath that, you could tell she had a real affection, a lot of love and affection for the residents and for her staff. Like, she was the only person who rung me up to check on me after I had my big bowel operation. And she was always a Christmas fanatic, like a Christmas fundamentalist, and would make it her mission in the care home to make it a really special occasion for the residents. And she even assigned herself her own Christmas, locked Christmas cupboard. From January, she'd start stockpiling all the items in preparation for it, including champagne, which was for on the Christmas, on the morning, the Christmas Day shift, for a 14-hour shift or a 7-hour shift, you only doing a half. You know, at 6:30 in the morning, the sound of buzzers going off already, kind of just the smell of shit. That this care home was very clean, very, very clean, really exceptional cleanliness standards, which it always got in its CQC report. But there's just a baked in, smell of shit in care homes that's unavoidable, just never leaves. And we'd stand in that office in the blinking light of fluorescent tube lighting, and we'd have a glass of mimosa, we'd cheers, and then we'd start a Christmas shift. And it's one of those taken for granted rituals that, you know, when you stand back from it, you realize that it sort of lends your life a nice continuity, which I mean I can't drink alcohol now, so then I would just have the orange juice. But I'm just trying to find the thing where I spoke about Christmas Day. Oh, yeah. So, like, in 2015, I actually missed. We're only supposed to give alcohol in moderation to care to residents unless they have capacity and then they can have as much as they fucking want. He used to have a guy pour Jameson over his cereal. So in 2015, I misjudged this. I accidentally got a man who fought at Dunkirk pissed on cans of Foster's, and he vomited into my cupped hands. And then later in the shift, he stripped his top half, so he was naked, like he had his top off, gently lowered himself onto the floor, and just laid face down on the carpet in the corridor. It was like that for quite a while before we found him. He was fine. He had his eyes open. He wasn't even sleeping. He was just laying face down on the floor, contemplating, just looking back at his life and thinking, Dunkirk was, oh, that was naff, tricky. That was Dunkirk. That, oh, naff tricky. That was. he got full like military send off for his funeral though, which was nice. I got a shout out. I got a little shout out at the funeral because I was always you know, a very good hands on carer. Lovely old boy he was. Oh yeah, sorry. I'm gonna go. I'm gonna make this a shorter one today, so I'm feeling a little bit woozy for some reason. I might do a bonus one. I might do a bonus one in the week as it's quite a short one. Love to all. Love to the kids. Keep the noise down. There's a baby next door. Laters. Sorry. A bit of a, rather than cutting it short, I found out I was going all sleepy and weird and listless because of my bowels. I've terrible bowels. I had to have a big part of them removed during operation. And then occasionally I get, I don't know when my body's trying to digest something, process something. I go really sleepy. Like I need, like my body goes into shutdown mode. And I can't really do anything. And I go really sleepy. I suppose so my body can limit its other functions and focus solely on remedying that, or, you know, kicking that out the back gate. So what we're talking about, our meritocracy. So Against Meritocracy by Joe Littler. Normcore plutocrats and the popularization of elitism. Well, we know that, I mean, Donald Trump is an elitist, but was also a very, very successful populist politician. He knew how to channel all the rage and the frustration of what they call in America the middle class, but which actually encompasses everyone in between the povos and the billionaires, basically. their class distinctions aren't as granulated as ours. I'll go back to that article. I've got lots to say. So I'll just read at random, like there's certain things I've highlighted to refer back to later. So disinterested, self-determining academies. Oh yeah, this is talking about academy school. Private capital seizing opportunities created by central government, which is what happens with privatized care, actually. Created by central government, extracts profit by providing what had been a community service. So, again, care work should be a community service, or an arm of the NHS has now been co-opted by a private enterprise. And, you know, that's why they have to pay exorbitant amounts, and the driving motivation for a lot of these people who have forgotten what they should be doing in the name of love. I'm talking about the directors. Now, the director, the company I used to work for, he was an experienced pro. You've got some people in higher positions who were had backgrounds in nursing and advocate person-centered philosophy, which are the people you want in those positions. They're the right people. But I sense that they're often overruled, or at least sometimes overruled, by the aestheticism of the head honcho, who's an experienced property developer. This might account for the money being wasted on decorative touches to entice new intake, such as expensive photographic prints of black and white daisies, rather than diverting the funds into the events budget or paying for new dishwashers. If these were installed in each of the dining rooms, it's a bit boring, but if these were installed in each of the dining rooms, it'd free up some of our time as carers, and this could be better utilised elsewhere, like deepening our relationship with the residents. And also, not to lump them all together, but this is how property developers or those who are in that world, this is how they communicate with one another. So in an essay entitled Cronyism and Clientelism for the London Review of Books by Peter Geoghegan, I can't pronounce his name, Geoghegan. He writes, it's the best summary, I suppose, but not even summaries, it's quite comprehensive. It goes in depth about the buddy-buddy, nepotistic, but more nepotism with friends rather than family members, quality of this government. And now Health Secretary Matt Hancock's just got himself in trouble by taking a private meeting with David Cameron, who was lobbying for a company that's just gone under now. Cronyism and clientelism. It's really, really good. And then he writes about Housing Secretary Robert Jenrick and businessman / pornographer Richard Desmond. Now, Desmond sought Jenrick's help in overruling planning inspectors and the local council, which is the localised government is where we should be. That's where this power should be shared with local government, but it isn't. And things like this, people from central government end up overruling what local councillors have said, and he overruled them to approve Desmond's West Ferry Printworks development 24 hours before the introduction of hefty new levies that would have cost a Conservative donor an estimated $45 million. After a fundraising dinner at the Savoy, where Jenrick was shown a promotional video of the proposed 1,524 apartment development in the Isle of Dogs, Desmond, referring to the Tower Hamlets Council, texted Jenrick the following message: "We appreciate the speed, as we don't want to give Marxists loads of dough for nothing." Now they talk to each other. And yeah, I think this is a big part of the problem with everything is like Stuart Lee, in that I've got a fear where he's on the front of the New Review, and the main quote from Stuart Lee is "Success is not a meritocracy," and he's right. He's right. There's sometimes it is. There's people who are getting ahead solely on talent. No, I can't think. I think that there's most people because even them, they're not socioeconomically privileged, but they came with connections. They didn't come to the comedy industry totally green. And I believe James Acaster did. I've heard him talk in interviews. I mean, but he's quite privileged, but he comes from, I don't know. He was amongst privileged peers. But yeah, I'm not chippy. I'm pleased for them. I just hate to see when there's people who get a shortcut to a certain amount of visibility through glad handing, through connections, and through having enough money to basically carve out a bit of leisure time to, in order to pursue this. It annoys me. It does. It's when you've kind of worked so hard and just thrown everything into this, and this is the only thing from my 20s that were a big write-off, but when I did work hard, it was always in pursuit of a career in comedy and a career in writing. And also just doing community-led stuff in comedy, and that wasn't for self-gain. Like, you know, it was stuff that wasn't going to give me any personal benefit. But, I don't know, I'm just being a bit... I think we all feel it. If there's other comedians listening to this, I think we've all... But there is part of me now that actually does, when I see people I like do well and get opportunities and get success, I kind of get a buzz off of it, and I find it galvanizing. Gives me momentum as well. And it's just there, sort of like a template of what they're doing. They're just an example of, I doing this quite strange comedy, I wouldn't have thought would have much mainstream success or much of like a mainstream appeal. Seeing it go, gain that audience, or at least, at least cultivate a really loyal, devoted fan base. It's nice. But there's two ways. So in the care home, there is a bit of a split between the worthy and life enhancing. Like, there's hierarchy in everything, though. Like, we're talking, there's the split between the worthy and life enhancing work of the care assistants, who are like the top tier amongst the grunts, and the titivating or sprucing of domestic staff. And then even lower than that, the laundry work, which is understood as the most, among the least skilled tasks. To characterize it in this way is totally unfair, but it's an unspoken division that I'm sure a lot of people who work in care homes will recognize. Under this assumption that dividing up the labor reduces the skills associated with the work, as well as the time required to learn the job, it thus justifies lower rewards as well as a speed up of the work. Equally important, such a strategy can increase an employer's control over the work and the worker. So with this divide and rule strategy that the top dogs have implemented, making us all split apart, making divisions amongst the lower ranks, so we all kind of turn on each other, and then the people at the top of the hierarchy once again benefit from our actions. But the second approach in this book called Wash... Can you actually believe this? Talk about niche, right? There is a book here that I own called Wash, Wear and Care by Pat Armstrong and Suzanne Day. It's an academic text. And the subtitle is Clothing and Laundry in Long-Term Residential Care. It's literally just about laundry in residential care, man. Exactly the kind of book I'd need. And would you believe they actually exist? And would they suggest the second approach is work organization that's flexible and, according to MacDonald in a paper, Martha MacDonald, actually, according to someone called Martha MacDonald in a paper entitled Post-Fordism and the Flexibility Debate, holds out a promise of more holistic jobs, a reversal of the increasingly detailed division of labour. In short, the promise of more satisfying, rewarding work for more people. This would mean care labour is organised to incorporate the work of laundry and clothing rather than that being a separate job, combining it with other labour. So this can mean more integrated care, more teamwork, and a more home-like atmosphere, which in theory I do actually agree with. So rather than having the laundry staff, the domestic staff, the carers, you have more staff doing all of those jobs. But that division is so deeply entrenched, I think just organically it would get divided anyway. It would get assigned to different people. Like you are carers, but you also, you're carers, but you're cleaning shit out of tights as well. You basically stay in there and do all the kind of clothes based stuff, but you are doing good, saving people's lives, the problem with organizing this work in a more inclusive, egalitarian way is that in socioeconomic terms, carers are already so undervalued and rarely have any opportunity to lord it over anyone else. So if we're to cling on to even a modicum of self-worth, we have to look down on the big, lumbering, awkward boy that works in the laundry room. And does LARPing on the weekends. we need Brian, basically. The big lumbering awkward boy that works in the laundry room, and he does LARPing on the weekends, and we need Brian, and we need him to retain a lower social status than the rest of us so we can bully him or make up rumours that he was caught masturbating in a wardrobe to feel better about themselves. Like Thomas Chatterton Williams, like in an essay entitled A Game of Chance, he wrote about René Girard's theory of the scapegoat mechanism. I've actually got that book, but I couldn't find it to quote from. And how escalation is diffused when the community unites against a single arbitrarily defined target and avoids a broader chaotic conflict as a result. When we channel our collective bitterness into the incompetence of domestic staff or night workers or laundry workers, social order amongst the care staff is restored. So it does. I mean, we don't want to bully anyone. I don't purposely bully anyone ever. I'll just, you know, I'll stick up for people being bullied and get my face, my block knocked off. But it's like in. It helps to coalesce the group if they have a common enemy. So Daro Breen says, as a tactic, he's got a particularly stubborn audience. He will really go in hard at them, so they will unite against him. So at least there's some some unity there, and then he will win them back as a unit, which is good. That's clever. It's a clever way of doing it. Yeah, I mean, you have to be a very good comedian to be able to be able to pull that off as well. So I wouldn't try it. Not yet. Get a few more years under my belt. I'll get to that level. Trust me. I'll put the work in. I'll get there, but I'm not there yet. You've got to know your limitations. Like, there's some gigs I was applying for when I was really quite new. I think we probably already all made this mistake, and like they would foff me off, but I had an unearned sense of self-worth and too much hubris, so I'd always be polite. I'd accept the rejection politely, but I'd always hint that they don't know who the fuck they're dealing with, and that one day I'm going to outpace them, and then they better watch their back. Just polite, disarming, trying to defuse the situation, telling them that I am going to wield my success as spite. And spite is very much the thing that will motivate me to the top. It's very polite, disarming, casual, congenial, you know, just chilling out. Nice. I mean, it's similar to how intravenous drug users like look down on the alcoholics in Narcotics Anonymous. I've never injected drugs, so I'm like one rank below the IV lads. But there's a universal understanding that when it comes to obliterating their lives, those who are addicted to opiates or crack or benzos have put the graft in. Alcoholics are just misogs. It's a kind of people who down Tiskies or Tyskies in a paddling pool during a son's sixth birthday and then undermine their wives' opinions at the buffet table. That's all an alcoholic is. But I was reading a great article about hustle culture within comedy. You're a self-starter in comedy, really, until you get picked up by an agent. But even then, you're still doing a lot of your own stuff, like your agents are there to facilitate, but they're not, you know, sometimes you have to arrange the first meeting, so to speak. You have to kind of get your foot in the door, and then they will help to negotiate deals and stuff. My experience of having agents has been, it's been lovely. They've been very, very collaborative. It's honestly no complaints thus far. I mean, it's been pandemic. It's been a weird time. So there hasn't been loads of activity, but there's been enough. And yeah, no, I really love my agents. Shout out to Hannah Layton and Steve Garland there. Good people. Got great people in their books as well. So give them a look. Patrick Kilty. Tanya Moore, I'm a huge Tanya Moore fan. I've seen her career go from strength to strength. Just, yeah, just great, 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 funny, funny comedian she is. So in this, hustle culture is ruining comedians. Hustle, so this is in Paste. Hustle culture, aka the billionaire mindset, tells you you never get more than 3 hours of sleep. Never stop networking. Never say no. The less you take care of yourself, the more worth you have. Regardless of the industry, an obsession with hustling is a surefire path to burnout, yet it is hardly ever acknowledged in stand-up despite its high prevalence. Yes, it is. And that's why I've been a bit more discerning. And like when I've been asked to pitch for different briefs, whether radio or television, I feel like I should... I've taken my focus from the stuff I should be focusing on to pitch that brief. So I thought, I can't let it pass me by. I might as well try. What's the harm in trying? But then I've seen the brief and I'm like, I do not like this brief. And it hasn't galvanized me. It hasn't sparked any kind of creativity in my mind. I don't think there's anything there that will kind of get the juices flowing. So I'm not driven by money. I'm driven by extreme, almost pathological adoration. I want you to adore me until you fucking vomit into my cupped hands and take your top off and lay down face first on the carpet in the hallway. I want you to be absolutely agonized by how much you love me. That's all I'm driven by. Simple, polite, you know, just no, you have to get up every day, do multiple shows a night, say yes to every gig, do every room. A too literal interpretation of Gladwell's 10,000 hours rule. It's perpetuated everywhere, from the club owner requires two late night credits for a booking to the indie booker that demands performers are getting up at least 3 times a week to do their basement show. Somewhere along the way, comedy became just a numbers game. Yes, this is what. Oh, yes. What I said about the arbitrary metrics of fucking, you know, got people like open micers going, got 1 million views on TikTok. I was like, they lubricate the algorithm. They make it very easy to, which is nice. It's good because it's a sort of a more democratic approach. But it hasn't translated into real world benefits or benefits with you can apply to the real world. That real world applicability, I was going to say, but it's not. It's real world, whatever. Anyway, you're chasing something that isn't. I don't know what are you hoping to gain out of it. If you're just doing it for fun, then great. If you're hoping to get other opportunities on it, I mean, in this country, the commissioning process was very risk adverse anyway. But they definitely made the mistake of chasing down every viral sensation and realized that it doesn't often bear fruit, though it does sometimes, like Mo Gilligan. But they realize, oh, Mo is a rare exception. He's like a multi-hyphenate, you know. He wasn't just a viral star, he was a brilliant presenter, a brilliant comedian. He's like quite a lot of strings to his bow, that young man. And you could tell that before he took off anyway. You could just tell it like on the live circuit. I think, yeah, there's some people who've done really well on during lockdown with their online content who are actually brilliant live as well. So I think they're able to parlay their online success into a good live comedy career. Alistair Beckett King, first one that comes to mind, brilliant live comedian. And done just wonderful stuff online as well. It just part of his whole like it seems consistent. Seems like a consistent part of his brand, if you know what I mean. So the brain poisoning brought on by hustle culture was on full display this last year. While some comics pivoted to safe digital shows, others wasted no time working around COVID precautions rather than with them to preserve their access to physical stage time. While some comedians on these lineups do indeed rely on stand-up to pay their bills, just as many can only rely on stand-up to pay for their Hulu subscription with ads. Even when they were given an out, a perfect excuse to take a beat, so many could not. But if we built a culture that validates your status as an artist around time clocked in, how could anybody feel comfortable sitting still? It's true. There's like people who have been Edinburgh winners. It gives you a lovely little boost, lovely bit of momentum, who haven't, I don't think, reached their full potential because they've got they've had a little bit of a reputation for, well, like for maybe not putting the work in. Well, I don't know how true that is, but they've probably just been, you know, they've probably just been normal and healthy with their work rate, but people expect so much more. They expect so much beyond that. And so we've got a thing where it's this weird thing where the ones who are at the top, you don't get the idle rich anymore. You don't get the idle rich. You get, I'm just looking for. Oh, I couldn't find now. It was basically a bit about how the people who are the, you know, the top one percentile, rather than the idle inherited wealth of yore, they say that these are people who are victims, but they're people who are also paralyzed with overwork and burnout in their lives. I'm trying to find it. In Mandler's usage, meritocracy is essentially the view that the education system should select by ability as tested by some form of open competition, resulting in deliberately differentiate trajectories and destinies. Sector system, that's all about these ideas. That's all about. I can't, yeah, no, I'll just have to talk through it. Shit, sorry, I did that last week, and I was listening back to just what bits. It annoyed me that there was so much of a lag there. I kept forgetting that you're not all seeing this on video. So, meritocracy, and in the book here, I've got as well, so The Myth of Meritocracy by James Bloodworth. I don't think I like James Bloodworth. I see him on Twitter, and I always think he's a bit of a... Can't quite place him. I think he's isn't he quite hostile towards doesn't he sort of stand in opposition to the new socialist left, which is fine. I stand in opposition to some of them are divs, some of them are, I don't agree with all things they say, but I think they're they've got a closed ideological system which I personally don't like, because it means they're inflexible, and I think their thinking becomes too rigid and self-contained, and there's no wiggle room there, so they don't. So they could never be convinced by another argument or think in bipartisan terms, or, you know, you put their hand across the aisle and find common ground. Like, if someone tells me they want to abolish kids, or you know, like, take away dogs, I want to hear them out. You've piqued my interest. It's quite an extremist sort of fanatical viewpoint, but yeah, you've got my attention. I just want to hear you out. Like, for assisted dying, to some people, that's controversial. Like, when I first became a carer, you had three floors. You had three floors on the top floor, you have what they call the double dementias, or late stage dementia. Or in the words of one of my colleagues called Sue, the ones who are proper fucked. It's not severe, whereas early dementia is slight confusion, a sort of faltering independence, manifests itself in lots of different ways. It's not severe. People who are in the earlier stages of dementia, which is the majority of the residents on the ground floor, they usually have a bit more life force, more elan. Is it pronounced elan? It's got a little hyphen on the top. I don't know what that means. What sound? Or is it on the A? No, it's on the E.
Elan.
They've got a bit more elan. Then the double dementias. The doubles live on the two floors above. A limbo within a limbo, where every new day is like an exhumation, a disturbance of souls who want to cut their losses and let go. Their quality of life is vastly diminished as their income. I believe in it, every life is a life, and you have to never treat them like they're subhuman or like they're already dead. You just don't know what flicker of cognizance they might retain. They might still be there. But from my standpoint, it looks like their quality of life is vastly diminished, as they're incapable of much communication and rarely seem to form the kind of friendships you'd witness between residents on the ground floor, or respond to any external stimuli, really. That's the main thing. They're like distant satellites silently roaming the edges of interstellar space. And in the book Limbo by Dan Fox, he writes, "I imagine limbo as an extra territoriality without corners, windows, entrances or exits, or a blind black void that has swallowed up all light and matter and threatens a sublime death," which is very upbeat image. It's not even sad, though, is it? It's just neutral. It's just kind of nothing. "It is a strange place, this limbo," wrote Samuel Taylor Coleridge, "in a time and wary space, fettered from flight, with nightmare sense of fleeing, strive for their last crepuscular half-being. When I first became a carer, this was how I envisaged the top floor, place in the shadows. And when I finally got to go up there, I realised it's not actually far off. It's confined to a single corridor. It's a languid atmosphere. Carers aren't rushing about. Everything is quieter. Some of the elders drift in and out of bedrooms or communal spaces. The rest of them are either bedbound or dumped in chairs and pointed at the television. In the eyes of some of the staff, they're nothing but mushrooms on a log." And Sarah Wootton and Lloyd Riley in Last Rites, the Case for Assisted Dying, said, "We are now familiar with the concept of person-centered care, where people are treated or not treated in a way that aligns with their attitudes and values. The campaign for a greater choice at the end of life once floated in an ether removed from mainstream medical discourse. Over time, it has fought its way into the centre of it. Nothing embodies the ideals of person-centred care more than giving dying people the choice, control and freedom they are asking for. Some of them are genuinely dying. They're experiencing like bodily death, the shutdown of vital functions, pumped full of oxycodone and morphine sulfate using a syringe driver, Fucking lucky. Lucky bastards. Can't believe they're wasting the good stuff on death. It's like pouring it down the drain. Absolute waste. And, but others force me to reevaluate what constitutes dying, or for that matter, what constitutes living. Yeah, I mean, as ones who, also, the syringe drive is a weird thing, man. It's like euthanasia and everything, but name only. Like, doctors will always make a conspiratorial, kind of clandestine, out the side of the mouth comment about it, you know, allowing them to, you know, ease their way into, submerge themselves into death. Basically saying, look, we're giving them a little scientist, you know, get to grease the wheels, so to speak. It's like, you're murdering these people. That's how it could be. But it's never spoken about in polite society. People never talk about the fact that you already do euthanasia, mate. It's a syringe drive. You're fucking killing them. You're fucking killing them, mate. So, yeah. Yeah. I totally believe in the case for assisted dying. I think... Alright, what's some of the arguments they make, actually? Actually, let's talk about... Let's end on... let's end on severed heads, basically. Let's end on severed heads. And it's by Julia Kristeva, who wrote the amazing book about the grotesque. The sublime grotesque. She also wrote a book about severed heads. And as it comes up a couple of times in my book and on my podcast, beheadings of 74. I thought I'd buy the book, 74. Beheadings. John the Baptist, prefigurer par excellence, lends his figure to the figuration of the invisible par excellence, the passage. Fixation is now ready to accommodate the mythical and biblical memory. No, figuration, sorry, is now ready to accommodate the mythical and biblical memory of beheadings. Because a history of decapitation really does exist in the various civilizations, one that is coming to be reconstructed. Texts, legends, fantasies detail 1,001 variations of severed heads. Their historical significance and local color echo the tormented vision of the artist who claims them and brings them back to life. Each time, contemporary in the graphic cut or crimson tint of his works. The graphic artist relies heavily on supposedly familiar texts, which the viewer is implicitly commended to read, but they're found in the drawing, or more or less freely interpreted, realised in the strict sense of the word figured. So I'll get to an example of someone's head. So we have, with a nervous, implacably parsimonious line, Luca Gambiasso captures Mercury preparing to cut off Argus's head. James Argent's head. So James Argent is a fat lad from Towie. And Luca Gambiasso. I know a comedian called Luca, but his second name is... What's his surname? He's a very funny guy. Really, really like him. Luca, comedian. I can't remember. So James Argent's head is cut off. He no doubt knew that James Argent, or Argos, also known as Argos. Oh, that's where you get Argos from. From a beheaded man. So how does that apply to Argos? We've cut the prices like Luca cut at my head. Price cut, head cut. Makes sense. Argos. The Prince of Argos, a son of Medea, had 100 eyes and bore the nickname of Panoptes the Luminous, all eyes. That's James Argent. He's been keeping that one under wraps. Mercury Hermes, the delivery people, and the winged god of travellers and merchants, which makes sense, managed to put him to sleep with the sound of his flute and kill him. James Argent, famous for hating the recorder, hating the sound of a recorder, was put to sleep by the sound of a postman's recorder. Because he was full of rage. His body shut down. And his body's also trying to process all those trans fats that is really it kind of protracted suicide for him. Eating himself to death in the unfun way. In the funnest way, I mean. The fun version of eating himself to death. Actually, I shouldn't say that. It's a fucking tragic death of Nicky Graham, man. Oh, no, that's actually, we'll end on that. RIP to Nicky Graham. The kind of cultural import of who is she? Just a brilliant bit of pop culture. Larger than life pop cultural icon. Larger than life, that sounds insensitive. Nicky Graham was excellent. And she died, but apparently she's had eating disorders. She's an eating disorder since the age of 8 years old. And the annihilatory experience of ward level anorexia nervosa is brutal. I was in rehab with a load of people who had it. I'd chat with them as we were queuing for drugs. And they always told me they'd been there for months on end. Like, properly heartbreaking. They were always there for, or even years, some of them, even years. I've got his book called Understanding Dunblane and Other Massacres. It's a subtitle, Forensic Studies of Homicide, Paedophilia and Anorexia. There was a girl I liked who had anorexia. She said she had it when she was younger. I don't know how present it was in her current life. But she had spoken to me about that. And I thought a way to bond and just a really ridiculous way to bond and to demonstrate my understanding of what she's spoken to me about and the fact that it wasn't a problem for me at all. It was like no judgment was to buy this book. Understanding Dunblane and Other Massacres and give it to her. Homicide, paedophilia and anorexia. She might have thought I was saying like, you're an anorexic and I'm a paedophile and this shows that we should be together. Oh, I'm not a paedophile. Thank you very much. As we said, if we want to talk about obliterating kids, I'm open. I'm open to that suggestion. A paedophile would really go like, wait, one sec. Just to circle back a second on that. Cool idea, cool proposal. Cool, I mean, you've got all the numbers and stuff here. Yeah, graphs, brilliant. Love it as a idea. But what might actually be better is doubling up on kids. Having more, having a big mountains of kids like that, tape them all together, and we can put them where we can see them, where I can see them in my private quarters, and I, you know, put big mountain of kids that I can tumble down during my tumbling exercises, which I have to do naked because. I get sweaty. Oh, no, that's disgusting. Disgusting. Slap on the hand. Come on, mate. So there is this article Digesting History as a Lifesaver by Peter Aylward. And it says here, the clinical case of a patient who developed anorexia nervosa to solve her own early terrors will be discussed. Concomitantly, this patient cut out her own history from her mind, culminating with the perverse pyrrhic victory in bringing about her own death. Her terror stemmed from the annihilatory experience of feeling excluded and unable to compete with an idolized sibling. That's why I've got it. I've got it in both directions. I went through a real stage of starving myself, severely underweight, gone totally the other way now, binge eating like you would not fucking believe. I bought 3 ice cream sundaes off Uber Eats yesterday. Heard my dad in the driveway, had to like eat them like a rat, just like bent over the fucking pizza box that they came in, so it was from a pizza shop, eating them like a rat until I got an ice cream headache, and I had to push through that because dad was going to come in and say hi and see the things and get fucking furious. So I had to eat them, and they had to get the boxes and shove them outside while my dad wasn't looking, like an illicit fat little asshole, like a fat deviant. That's no way to enjoy ice cream. It wasn't even enjoyment. It was just compulsion. Her resistance to meaningful engagement with her past, given that it was too painful, infected and affected the capacity of the treating team to include it. This resulted in her earlier terrors being projected into the treating team regarding the prospect of her death. Yes, my brother was a sportsman, and I was always compared to my brother and his physical abilities, and my brother always made me feel really shit about my body. So then I went through a stage of doubling up on my clothes, wearing clothes underneath all my clothes, even in the summer. So I was pouring with sweat to bulk myself up, and I did bulk myself up and I got really in shape. My brother still would take the piss out of my body if I saw him, and then I got fat. I've got real insecurities about that. And then in fact I was absolutely riddled with cystic acne at one point. So yeah, you wouldn't think it. I don't really talk about my body that much. Don't really talk about sex that much, unless it's in a kind of knowingly puerile and piggish way, because I have real hang-ups about that as well. I'm very, very insecure in my own skin, which has got a lot better as I've got older. It used to be paralyzing. And as I've got older, it's kind of like, it's fine. I need to do something about it. I want to be healthier. I don't want to be puffed out at the time, but I can walk around with a straight posture and my belly sticking out a little bit, and just only have to breathe in when I see a fit bird. That's enough for today. Love you all. We've got a lot extra there, whether you want to listen to it or not. That's your call. See you next week.